This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Green Party won four seats in this year's election, and in Bristol, its co-leader Carla Denyer unseated the Labour frontbench of Fangham Debonair.
Bristol, you made history today.
But in the midst of a climate crisis so urgent that people are bypassing parliamentary politics and taking direct action, what can Green MPs achieve? This week, I'm sitting down with Carla for a conversation about politics, protest, and where she wants the Greens to go next. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Hello, Carla.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Here's a fairly obvious first question. You have been an MP for just over a month now. How is the Westminster environment for you?
Pretty strange. Some of your listeners might have seen my colleague Ellie Chowns' speech in the chamber last week.
I saw a bit of that, yeah.
In a debate about modernising the House of Commons. And I think it struck a chord because it got shared around quite a bit. We all knew how out of date the systems in the House of Commons are and the traditions, some of which don't really serve us anymore. But it was really striking to her because she is used to pretty common sense things like in the voting chamber, everyone gets a seat.
Yeah.
You can vote electronically.
Yeah.
That you don't have to put down a prayer card several hours before you want to sit in the chamber like some kind of towel on a sun lounger in order to get yourself a seat.
And if you mention someone else, you have to have in your head where they're the MP for. You have to say the member for.
Yeah, exactly. Which is an astonishing
outer Strachan
memory test.
Wherever. Yeah.
Given how many newbies there are, especially.
That feeling of outsiderness as a Green Party MP must be huge. Because you're outside these two traditional blocks, steeped in history, and the idea that they sort of have the run of the place, right? And there's only four of you and all of those things, right? You're an anomalous presence.
To be honest, I think it's probably a good idea if I try and cultivate keeping that outsiderness.
You like
because
it?
I just think that I'm not sure it'll be good for democracy if we all get very comfortable and we sink into the sort of disproportionate deference and some of the customs that don't really serve us. Of course, I'll continue to be respectful and use the terms that you're meant to in the chamber in debate and so on. But I think it's good to have a fresh pair of eyes and an approach of why is it that we do this again?
Let's talk a bit about your background. Where did you grow up and go to school?
I grew up in Fleet in Hampshire, and most of my family are from that area around the Hampshire-Surrey border.
That's near the M3. There's a service station.
Sorry, people of Fleet. But yes, one of the most well-known things about it is that it has a service station. It was sort of built mostly in the Victorian era. There's a pond or a lake there, and I think there were lots of Victorians travelling down from London, and it's sort of built around that.
And would it be fair to say that was quite a sort of conservative, right-inclined sort of place to grow up?
Yes, I wasn't really very aware of or engaged in politics at the point that I lived there, but yes, conservative voting suburbia, basically.
And where did you go to school?
I went to one of the two local state schools in the town, Calthorpe Park.
Okay.
And in other interviews, I've talked about how that was quite formative for me because in that school, we had a teacher who had recently graduated from Oxford, who was brought in, I think, if I remember rightly, as part of Blair's, I can't remember what the scheme was called, but basically it's something like super teacher, except that wasn't the term, where sort of recently graduated students came and taught in a state school to try and give us some of the experience that people might have had in more expensive education. Anyway, long and short of it is that teacher, Mr. Horgan, set up a debating society in my state school, which, of course, most people don't get to have that experience. And although I had absolutely no intention of being a politician at that point or for another decade or so afterwards, looking back, he probably gave me some of the experiences that are now serving me quite well.
Keir Starmer calls oracy. He thinks that's very important, the ability to sort of clearly and fluently express yourself in public. And you acquired that skill at your state school.
Yeah, and we did. We took part in debating and public speaking competitions, and we were very often the only state school in those competitions.
Stands you in good stead for
I think so.
Doing the same thing in the House of Commons, debating with posh people.
Yes, exactly. I got back in touch with that teacher, Mr. Horgan, recently, and we met up for a coffee. It was rather nice.
Good for him. Right. Unlike a lot of politicians who tend to have degrees, if they have degrees, in things like philosophy, politics and economics or law and all those things, you are an engineer in terms of your educational, but your academic background. That's right, isn't it?
Yep, and career. So I did mechanical engineering at Durham University, and then I moved to Bristol for my first job after uni about 15 years ago to work in the renewable energy sector.
Wow. I read somewhere that when you were at Durham University studying mechanical engineering, you had a sort of epiphanic moment about the climate crisis. Is that correct?
Yeah, it wasn't a single
moment.
Sounds
a bit Hollywood, this. Like you suddenly realised it was probably more complicated.
Exactly. I'm often asked what was the moment where you decided to do something about climate change or what was the moment you decided to go into politics. And none of these in reality were single moments. I doubt they are for many people. But it was in the summer holiday between my second and third years at uni. It was just a combination of, I was already thinking about this because I went on a summer course with the Royal Academy of Engineering that was about finding out what it's like to work in the renewable energy industry. So I was already interested. But the combined effect of going on that course, reading a few books over the summer holidays.
Name a couple of the books that you read that kind of...
So the one that I vividly remember that influenced this was simply The Rough Guide to Climate Change. So the Rough Guide series. That sort of percolated through my brain over the couple of months of the summer holiday to make me realise, right, okay, climate change isn't just one of a few different issues. It is the biggest crisis facing humanity. And it was pretty self-evident to me straight away, okay, I'm going to dedicate my life to tackling this somehow. How am I going to do it? Well, I'm halfway through an engineering degree, so I'll try and get a job in renewable energy. Did that. That was what brought me to Bristol. Worked in renewables for about 6 years.
Which particular bit of renewables?
Offshore and onshore wind.
Okay.
So I wasn't out on the wind farms going up the turbine towers, unfortunately. So I've got no lovely pictures of me with a hard hat on. I was working on them at a much earlier stage where I worked for a consultancy. So we would be hired by either developers or the other side banks that were thinking of lending to them to do an accurate assessment of how much energy the wind farm could generate, therefore how much money it would make, and then they could get a loan based on that.
But clearly what you chose to do for a living had a strong ethical or political,
100%.
At least with a small p dimension. When did you join the Green Party then?
So for context, I graduated in 2009, moved to Bristol.
Don't say that, I found that terrifying. Anyway, go on.
I graduated in 2009, moved to Bristol that autumn, and then I joined the Green Party in late 2011. So, and with, I was still at that stage, absolutely zero intention of being a politician myself. I just joined the Greens because I realised that I shared the Green Party's values and I wanted them to do better and I wanted to donate some of my spare time and my money to contributing to that. So I got involved in my local party initially as membership secretary and I was events coordinator as well for a while. But yeah, one thing led to another and there was in the run up to the 2015 election where there was big local elections in Bristol as well as a general election and we were targeting the seat of Bristol West as it then was for the first time. I was part of the core team that was organising our general election campaign and we were trying to make sure we had good local council candidates in every seat as well so that we could get more councillors elected and because when you're a small party, one of the best ways of getting an MP elected is to already have some hardworking councillors there for people to know what you're about. And I got asked if I would consider standing in one of those council seats and I initially said no because I didn't really see myself as a politician. And continued to say no another half a dozen or so times, but eventually said yes and didn't look back. Turns out I quite enjoy the job.
Tell me about Bristol as a sort of crucible for green politics. I'm very fond of Bristol. I don't live that far from Bristol, right? And it is a fascinating place, full of a sort of spirit of disobedience and radicalism, albeit with quite a troubled history. If one takes the long view, Bristol's links to slavery.
Absolutely.
I
made that point in my maiden speech, in fact.
Yeah. Notwithstanding all of those things, which give its politics this sort of radical edge, it remains a very segregated city.
Yeah.
In terms of race and class, actually. it's sort of full of an inequality which it doesn't seem to have done much about thus far. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it is quite a divided city. Within my constituency of Bristol Central, there are areas with some of the lowest percent of five or more GCSEs A to C, right next to areas with some of the highest density of people with PhDs in the country. And yeah, that's a real issue. And I think, honestly, it is part of the reason why Green Party policies have been resonating with people in the city, because we are not afraid to talk about the level of change that's needed. And in the run-up to the local elections that we had earlier this year and this general election, I think a lot of voters were seeing that Labour was only really offering incremental change, and it was the Greens that were talking about tackling wealth inequality, introducing a wealth tax, properly investing in public services that everybody relies on, but often that those on the lowest incomes rely on more. And that was the breath of fresh air that a lot of people wanted, and something that they could believe in.
Do you feel, though, that in the midst of a city which is both very unequal and also has that kind of radical political aspect, that you have to be careful that you don't get a sort of radical politics which floats away from social reality and becomes very sort of pleased with itself and pious and forgets about class, right? There is a sort of left-wing politics which likes to forget about class and pretend it's not there, right? And I suppose some people would say that there is a sort of Bristolian kind of politics which is open to that accusation.
Yes, I was sorry, I was slightly smirking at you because I was about to say, and the same could be levelled at The Guardian, probably.
No,
sorry.
I think this is an issue for people and organisations of the political left generally. It's always a danger. Yeah.
No, I think it's a fair point. And the fact that our Green councillor group is now more diverse than it's ever been, I think is a hopefully somewhat of an antidote to that we have elected Green councillors from a wide variety of different backgrounds and lived experience themselves.
Under your co-leadership, the party won a historic 4 seats in the general election. You unseated Thangham Debonair, the Labour MP, in the new seat of Bristol Central. You will know that she has said that you fought a somewhat unfair campaign, that you put out leaflets casting doubt on her record on Gaza. She said was unfair. She said she voted for a ceasefire twice, and that the campaign material that you put out gave a distorted impression of that. What's your response to that?
I think it's really important to talk about policies and to play the ball, not the player. And that's always the approach I've had in politics. But it is important to make sure that voters know what their MP has voted for and whether they've represented Bristol residents' views or not.
So now, what was her case to answer on Gaza?
Well, first of all, a consistent 3/4 of the entire British population have supported a ceasefire since the 7th of October consistently. I haven't seen Bristol's central specific polling, but I would hazard a guess it's even higher in Central.
Okay.
And in the first vote in the Commons on a ceasefire, Keir Starmer whipped the Labour MPs to abstain.
Okay.
And there were some Labour rebels, but all 4 of the Labour MPs in Bristol abstained. It is true that a few months later, Labour MPs voted for a motion that did call for a ceasefire with slightly different wording and one that they'd put forward rather than another party. But tens of thousands of people were killed, injured, or made homeless between the first opportunity to vote for a ceasefire and the second.
That's a more nuanced take on what happened, which she said was sort of omitted from Green campaigning.
Well, I think the fact that Labour failed to vote for a ceasefire at an early stage when it could have made a substantial difference. Now, I know that Labour weren't in government at the time, but had there been a vote with substantial support in the Commons, that could well have nudged the previous government to a position of pushing for a ceasefire much faster than has now happened. And my concern is human rights and international law. And if human rights don't apply to everyone equally, then what's the point? And I think that's the overwhelming view of the British public and certainly of people in Bristol Central. And they were disappointed to see the Labour Party equivocating over that.
Here is a bigger picture question about the Green Party and politics in the UK. Sometimes it feels remarkable to me that if you compare Britain with Germany, it's the obvious European country to pick. The Green Party here, as against the Green Party there, have not been a big presence right at the heart of politics. Why do you think that is? If you blame the electoral system, I'll have an adverse reaction to that, because we both know that's part of it, but it's not the whole story.
Well, I do think it is the largest part of it, because if we had a fair voting system here, then I think even we'd have 20-something Green MPs. That might have even been based on the last general election. I think it might be even more this time.
Yeah, you'd argue I'd have even more, because people would feel empowered to vote Green.
Exactly.
Whether or not they wouldn't have to tactically vote and all that stuff. But it's not, much as we can probably both agree, that is a very substantial part of the reason why. But successful political projects tend to be good at self-criticism as well, and to say, look, we need to do this better, or we haven't been doing enough of this, or we've been doing this wrong. Are there things on that score that you think are relevant here?
I think that if you looked back 10, 15, 20 years ago, the Green Party talked about our policies in more of an abstract way, and our leaflets tended to look like essays. They had a lot of text, not very many pictures, and rather a lot of long words that didn't really entice you to read them. We have now got better at communicating more straightforwardly what we're offering, why it helps you.
Do you think to some extent you have a sort of split personality or personalities as a party, that there are people who perhaps want to be part of the political mainstream, who look more like, I wouldn't say orthodox necessarily, but like you'd expect a politician to be, or a lot of people would. And then there are people who are much more rooted in a sort of political counterculture and are much more sort of edgy and radical and militant in their outlook, right? Now, I'm not being critical of that necessarily, but the two things together can be an awkward fit. So between some Green Party people I've met and one of your previous co-leaders, Jonathan Bartley, for example, there seemed to be a whole sort of universe between those two things, right? That was quite a contrasting set of faces to present to the electorate.
I definitely recognise that there's a spectrum of opinion in the Green Party, but I don't really think it's any bigger. In fact, I would probably argue it's smaller than the spectrum of opinion in other parties. I mean, look at the Labour Party. Obviously, that's a huge tent and one that successive leaders have really struggled to keep together.
Yeah, they're throwing people out of the tent increasingly at speed. It's becoming slightly smaller, but
increasingly, yeah. And a sentiment that was repeatedly expressed to me on the doorstep speaking to voters in Bristol was that there were people who knew they agreed with me and the Green Party more than the Labour Party on policies when Starmer was first elected as co-leader.
But you think you're more coherent.
But they wanted to give Starmer a chance precisely because he'd sold himself initially that he would be a big tent kind of guy.
Yeah, sure, okay.
And then that proved not
but
to
let's talk
really
about,
be the
we're
case.
Talking about the Labour Party here. Let's go back to the Green
yeah,
Party.
So
you think you're more coherent and sort of unified in that sense than the Labour Party?
I think there is a bit of a spectrum of views, from sort of deeper greens to bright greens is one term that's used. But I think on the vast majority of policies...
Who are the deepers and who are the brights?
I guess deep green is kind of more of an ecological frame of mind, and bright green is perhaps a bit more pro-technological solutions.
Okay.
You know, I don't think there's anyone in the Green Party that's like, yeah, let's just do carbon capture and storage and carry on burning the same amount of gas as before. But there's definitely a little bit of a spectrum of opinion.
But there's still a watermelon element of the Green Party. I met them a few times who were called that because they're sort of socialists on the inside and green on the outside. They're more sort of politically left in an orthodox sense than some other elements of the Green Party. There's nothing wrong with having these factions, incidentally. I mean, that's what all political parties
no,
are.
No, like. I'm just laughing because I feel like you've been having a chat with Owen Jones, who's absolutely obsessed with the fruit analogies. And every time he interviews
me... No, it's not. It's when I went to Green Party conference once, I met a number of self-styled watermelons.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. So
it's in Bristol, actually.
Watermelon is a term that some people use, but I think most people use with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, to be honest, because the Green Party's policies are progressive. I don't think there's much of a divide in the party on that. There are perhaps some people who have come to the Greens from the Labour Party or from voting Labour, and so see themselves in that slightly more kind of defining themselves relative to socialism or being a social democrat. I think that Green Party political philosophy it's its own thing. It's not a branch of... You can't just define it as being, oh, well, it's like being a social democrat,
oh, no,
you change this or whatever. It's a different thing.
Well, people have this idea that the Green Party is full of people who in the ideal world would be in the Labour Party and so on. I mean, it's not like that at all. A completely different political tradition.
Yeah. One of the things that's different is the Green Party is really inherently grassroots, bottom up.
Yeah.
So
you're not statists,
in terms
you?
Of how we organise as a party. So our policies are set one member, one vote. at a party conference, and the leaders don't get to veto things like Starmer does. But also in terms of the policies that we then would want to roll out in the country, it's all about making decisions at the lowest practicable level by the communities that are affected as far as possible.
We're going to pause now. When we come back, more from Carla Denyer.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in the Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me ask you about something else. We both know that Just Stop Oil is very regularly in the news. It's been very vividly in the news over the last few weeks because of the prison sentences given to five Just Stop Oil activists, who included Roger Hallam, the co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, but a sort of big noise in Green Direct Action. How do you feel about that?
I think the case is, the court case and the sentences are clearly disproportionate.
Yeah.
When you look at the time they have got in prison compared to what you typically get for other crimes, including violent crimes, it was shocking.
Yeah.
And I and other Greens made that point loud and clear as soon as that news came out.
Okay. And then, but the idea that the cause of climate action is well served by that kind of activism. What's your position on that?
Maybe/probably, I think, is my answer. So where does it reach
a point where you're uncertain? Because it sounds like there's a measure of uncertainty in there in certain cases, right?
Yeah, so there is no doubt that Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, Insulate Britain, etc., pushed climate change up the agenda. They successfully got in the news over and over again, and they got politicians and pundits and journalists to talk about it. That was their aim. It is not the theory of change that I have. I've taken part in protests in the past, but for the last more than a decade now, my theory of change has been get Greens elected directly into the Commons, into the Senate, into town and city halls across the country to directly propose the policies that will bring about these
solutions. As an expression of that difference within yourself, are there occasions when, or have there been occasions when, that people take that sort of direct action and you recoil, right? Now, I actually think personally, and we'll come on to this in a moment, that faced with this emergency, I understand why people want to do those things, and people say, oh, it was just powder paint and so on. But the idea of defacing Stonehenge in any way, I just thought, A, I don't like that instinctively, but B, politically, that's just going to be massively counterproductive. So I recoiled. I recoiled even though there was glass in front of it when they threw soup on the Van Gogh painting. I didn't like that instinctively. Where were you on those things?
Yeah, I think the Stonehenge one especially, I wouldn't have taken part in a protest like that, because what did Stonehenge ever do to you? What did Stonehenge ever do to contribute to climate change? That doesn't seem like
or poor old Vincent van Gogh equally.
It doesn't seem like a well-targeted... And I think Stonehenge even more so because of its significance to so many people. But as you said, I agree. I absolutely understand why people feel driven to take direct action like this, because they rightly feel that successive governments have simply not taken the climate emergency seriously.
Yeah, they would say, and I'm sure they do, that it's very good that there are now four Green MPs, but there are only four. And it's very good that you have as many councillors as you have. But again, you still haven't got the largest number of councillors, etc. So progress is slow, right? Relative to the gravity of the emergency that we're faced with.
Which is partly why the Green Party is really clear that there is an important role for protests and non-violent direct action in a healthy democracy. And I think we stand alone on that in the UK, in that it's really clear, it's written into our core policy principles, that there is an important role for protest. And
if it involves disruption. then yeah, so be it.
Non-violent, it has to be, of course, non-violent. But if, you know, so many of the rights that we've got in this country, including weekends, for example, the right to vote for women, were all
suffragettes smashed windows in central London. It wasn't all there, just
that,
sitting in their own and chaining themselves to railings.
That wasn't entirely non-violent.
No, no.
But point is, protest is usually inconvenient. That's how it gets the results. Doesn't mean I necessarily agree with the tactics of every single protest,
yeah,
but I support their right to do
it. It's a delicate walk sometimes, though, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. But look, I'm not on this podcast to be a spokesperson for Just Stop Oil. Get them on if you want to ask them about the detail of the tactics.
No, but you both want. But I support but you both broadly want the same things. It's just that your chosen means of doing it are different, right? And that creates tensions that are interesting. And I think it's worth asking you about.
I don't think it's that much of a tension. I think we coexist. We have different theory of change, but we are ultimately pushing towards a similar goal.
How anxious are you about the tide turning against climate action politically because of the political right being in the midst of quite a sort of thriving political period, it seems. We all know what's going on in the States and across Europe. And the fact that climate action has become a culture war issue, right?
Yeah, it's really worrying. The fact that the Conservatives over the last parliament gave into or arguably even hastened the collapse of the cross-party consensus that climate change is serious and we need to do something about it urgently is really concerning, especially when the majority of Brits want to see parties go faster on climate change. Whenever it's polled, there's always a majority of Brits actually want the party in government to go faster. And yet some PR person or think tank must have told Sunak that the way to get a few more votes was to roll back on a load of climate and environment policies. So when he delayed and abandoned some of those policies around making homes more energy efficient, delaying the rollout of electric vehicles, he must have thought he was going to get some kind of electoral benefit from it. And yet the polling that came out after that announcement showed that the Conservatives got a poll bounce of precisely 0%. So it's this misguided idea that they are appealing to what the public want.
There is something of a division within the Green Party or elements of the Green Party about people who are in favour of trans rights and so-called gender critical people. And there's been quite a lot of noise generated by the debate and tension, really, between those two elements. There is an organisation called Green Party Women who feel that they have a right to be in the Green Party. Many of them, as I understand it, are long-standing Green Party members and activists. They're feminists and so on, and they feel that they've been unfairly maligned and treated. Given that you're the co-leader, do you think those elements can be accommodated, that they both have a right to be in the Green Party, or do you think the so-called gender critical views of the kind of people who are gathered in Green Party Women are now beyond the pale?
Now, first, there's a few different answers to this question. So
give them all.
Green Party policy is really clear. We support trans rights. We recognise that trans men are men, trans women are women, non-binary people exist and are valid. We want to push for better access to trans healthcare, for demedicalising and de-bureaucratising. Is that a word? The process of getting a gender recognition certificate, which is currently overly bureaucratic and, yeah, it's not very humane. Those are all policies that have passed at our Green Party conference, supported by members, one member, one vote. And those reflect my views as well, and I believe the majority of Green Party members. Yes, there is some differences of opinion, some debate and discussion in the Green Party, as there is across UK society at the moment and in all other political parties as well. So as the Greens, we're not immune to it. In terms of, is there space for people with different views to be in the party? If they are expressing those views respectfully, then, yeah, I don't expect any party member to agree with 100% of the Green Party's policies. It'd be pretty rare to find a member of any political party who agreed with absolutely 100% of our policies. But if that disagreement on policy then strays into intentionally disrespecting trans people, intentionally misgendering them, arguing for a reduction in fundamental human rights to be treated equally, then that's where I don't think.
And do you think that has happened?
There have been a small number of cases where I think that's happened. I hesitate only because the complaints and disciplinary process in the party is quite rightly totally independent from my role as leader. So I rightly don't have visibility of the fine detail
but
of that.
Do you think it's possible to hold gender critical opinions and yet conduct the debate and participate in the debate in a way that is respectful and so on, and therefore to stay within the sort of lines you're talking about? Or is there something about the views themselves, as you see it, that then risks people crossing a line?
I think it ought to be possible to have a fair and open discussion about what are the best policies to pursue.
And to say, I happen to have a gender, in the case of these people, to say, well, I happen to have a gender critical position, which isn't the party's policy position, but nonetheless, I am entitled to be a member of the Green Party the same as anyone else.
Yeah, I don't think that the Green Party or any party should be kicking people out for having a different policy opinion, and we haven't. There have sometimes been instances of individuals manifesting that in a way that harasses individuals, manifesting it in a way that means they're campaigning against properly selected Green Party candidates. That's where it steps into, that's not appropriate behaviour.
And is it true on both sides that both sides have a duty to be respectful?
Of course. I always want to see respectful debate in the party.
So as far as we understand it, unless something kind of crazy happens, this parliament will run for at least 4 years. That's a safe assumption given the size of the Labour majority. When Caroline Lucas announced that she was standing down, I interviewed her. And she actually did have a list of what she'd achieved. She could rattle it out. She said, well, I did this and I did this and this changed because of something I did and so on. Looking ahead, do you have something similar or a set of similar things in mind? That if we meet again in 2028 or 29...
You're going to play this clip back at me and see how many...
No, that there are things that you would like to think that you will have done, or changes you will have made, or shifts in the debate about this, that and the other that might have happened.
Yeah. So in the short term, and in the first week of the new parliament, myself and the other Green MPs put out a statement talking about the things that we thought the new Labour government could and should do in its first 100 days. And that you will have already seen our work on some of those. So pushing Labour to lift the two-child benefit cap, which we think is cruel and unnecessary and not even that expensive to lift.
Okay.
Ending the de facto ban on onshore wind, which has happened. Hurrah. But there's other things around renewables.
You brought a list by the look of it. Is that true?
Yeah, well,
good. That's a good thing, incidentally.
Yes. Well, I write things down when I want to remember
them. Keep going.
And this was the notes that we took in with us in the first week in Parliament. And yes, it's good to end the de facto ban on onshore wind, but we think that there's more that they could do. For example, why not make solar panels compulsory on all new suitable homes and make high quality insulation the norm in all new homes? Because at the moment, this country is building homes that immediately need to be retrofitted, which is a lot more expensive and complicated than doing it right the first time around. That's the kind of policy that could be done fairly swiftly, could make a big difference.
What you've just said also gets me into the final question about how you feel looking at this new government and where it's going and what you think your role is, right? Because I wouldn't imagine on the morning of July the 5th you thought, oh, well, this is just the same thing with a red rosette on now, right? You must have had some sense, did you, that something significant politically had happened and that this would be a different government in certain important respects. Is that fair to say?
Of course. It's not. It's simply not accurate to say that the Conservatives and the Labour Party are indistinguishable, although it is fair to say that the Labour Party have been heading further and further towards the Conservatives in terms of
policy. I mean, personally, it's quite good that they've come along wanting to tax VAT on private schools, that's private school fees, and renationalise the railways,
yes,
and
absolutely.
Have a publicly owned energy company and with the aim of clean electricity generation by 2030.
You know, yeah, and I've said that, including in the Commons Chamber, that I think Great British Energy is a potentially promising proposal. However, the level of investment that's being proposed by the Labour government doesn't touch the sides of what's needed in terms of climate investment. So it's a good start. But they originally had flagship $28 billion investment pledge. So that's $28 billion a year. What they're proposing now is $8.3 billion over 5 years. So that's a tiny proportion of what they were previously proposing.
So what's your job then, right? If you're not going to be just a completely anomalous, largely irrelevant group of four principled, no doubt, well-intentioned MPs and to have real political impact, what's your job as far as the new government is concerned?
I think it is to be fair and acknowledge where they're doing the right thing and work with them when they are, but not being afraid to speak up and push them to be bolder where we don't think they're going far enough. Recognising that we are a small parliamentary party for now, we have to work cross-party on areas we agree, and that's how Caroline Lucas worked as one Green MP, and it's how we will work as four. But being a group, we can hopefully have a substantially greater impact.
I'm not sure if there's a mathematical pattern going from one to four and then what follows next, if it's sort of exponential. Do you also have some idea in mind of ideally how many more Green MPs you'd like to have come the next general election?
I don't have a number for you yet, but we are looking very closely at the results that we got in other seats. And my colleagues will be crunching numbers. I mean, they are crunching numbers literally as we speak to work out how many we might be able to target next time around.
Should be 16.
Given that we
to four is then times four, so then the next jump is 16.
Yeah, well, that would be lovely if we just quadruple. Maybe we could even more than quadruple. We've more than quadrupled our number of councillors across five consecutive local elections. So quadrupling our number of MPs seemed ambitious to some, but we knew that it was possible if we campaigned smart enough, and that turned out to be the case.
You're an optimist, aren't you?
Yeah, of course. And we did come second in 40 constituencies in this general election, which was way above what I thought would be possible. So I think that stands us in good stead.
Great. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Week the UK wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahart and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence.
Discover more in The Guardian's series, Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.